welcome, subscribers. A warm welcome. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you for being here. We are continuing our excellent program with David Wilcock. Fascinating discussion here continues. And, you know, to begin this segment here, I would like just to comment and backtrack a little bit and say that, you know, so fascinating to hear all the scientific background that you've been, you know, sharing with us here, and that this kind of incorporates the spiritual aspect and also takes it away from the kind of, I guess, a little bit from the magical level and takes it into a very, you know, real thing, so to speak, that we actually can understand in a totally different way. What I would like to ask you is basically, I can see now why, you know, you've teamed up with Richard Hoagland a little bit, because I think your work kind of dovetails here, it feels like, anyway. I don't know if this is the case or you know, but, you know...
His original book, Monuments of Mars, I got in 1993 after hearing about his presentation at the United Nations. And that really started me off on this, what he calls hyperdimensional physics, where he's describing how, like, if you look at Jupiter with the Great Red Spot, 19.5 degrees below the equator on all these planets and the sun, you see these energetic phenomena. Like, you get Hawaii on Earth, these volcanic mountains. You get the largest volcano on Mars is at 19.5.
Mm-hmm.
You get cloud bands on Saturn. You get the Great Red Spot on Jupiter, you get the Great Dark Spot on Neptune, you get sunspots that don't go higher than 19.5 on the sun. So for years, once I started to put all this research together, I was trying to capture his attention. I started participating in this discussion group in 1996. I finally got his email address in 2000, and by 2001, we were in fairly regular communication. Then in 2003, we actually made our affiliation with each other public for the first time by co-authoring a paper on interplanetary climate change, showing that what's happening on the Earth with global warming is a phenomenon occurring throughout the solar system. What he's working on right now is really fascinating insofar as he has published a book called Dark Mission, which is talking about NASA actually being a defense agency of the government, not just an exploration agency. It's actually chartered as a defense agency. And it also says that anything that is deemed to be inimical to the security of the United States is kept secret in NASA. So that includes the Roswell crash. Well, he doesn't go into UFOs, I do, but the Roswell crash, and then also if there's any ruins on other planets. So Richard's focus has always been on extraterrestrial ruins that can be photographed and studied. And most of the time he's focused on Mars, and there's some very interesting things on Mars, as you probably well know. But this particular book talks about what typically look like very large, very ancient glass structures on the moon. So you could argue, for example, that if you wanted to colonize the moon, you would build a giant glass dome so that it held in an atmosphere. And then inside that glass dome, you could grow plants, you could, you know, have buildings, and people could walk around without spacesuits on. The whole key is to keep building these glass domes that'll hold the atmosphere. Well, what if that civilization was so old that in the meantime, you've had all these little micrometeorites that have beat up these domes, and there's nothing left inside or outside, because the domes have cracked, and all the moon dust has gotten in there and covered up all the stuff that was in there. But as a result of how transparent the glass is, it's very difficult to see that the domes are still there. It appears that NASA was well aware that these domes existed and that most of the Apollo landing sites were intended to be located right near these domes. And yet they're so difficult to see just with the naked eye anyway that they didn't really show up very well in the photographs, but NASA would go a step further and then blot out the glass so that you couldn't see it in the images.
And
so this is where Ken Johnston comes into play. Ken Johnston was working for NASA in the early 70s, and he worked for them during the Apollo missions as well. And one day he was given an order to destroy about 11 or 12 file cabinets worth of original photographs from the moon. They had five sets of photographs. This is from all the Apollo missions that walked on the moon, from 8 or 9 up until, I guess, 16 or something, 17.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the exact numbers, but somewhere around that number. And this was, you know, an enormous number of photographs that they said destroy them. And so he actually felt it was a travesty and saved one set of photographs. Now think about it. If you were going to go back and alter the originals, you wouldn't want there to be extra copies of the unaltered version. You'd want to only have your altered photographs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Johnston saved these photographs and kept them in very good condition. And what happens is that when you start analyzing these photographs and then use very simple things in Photoshop that nobody could have imagined we would have had back then, you start finding all this stuff that shouldn't be there.
Hmm.
You know, these little things that you almost can't even see in the photograph, but when you amp up the contrast and the brightness, all of a sudden, man, what is that?
They're still there, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
So Richard has teamed up with his colleague Mike Barra from LunarAnomalies.com. They wrote this book, Dark Mission, primarily as a result of the incredible support from the Coast to Coast AM audience from George Norrie's radio show. It's propelled the book into bestseller status on New York Times, and it's been number 21 for at least 2 weeks in a row on there. So it's getting attention. He also recently had a conference in the National Press Club,
mm-hmm.
which is the most prestigious press organization in the United States, where all the world's media converge on very important events. And what was so fascinating was that the Russian media showed a very strong interest in this.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So they came with their cameras, and all the major television networks covered it on their news programs. He's got front page stories on Russian newspapers. Russian R&D websites are talking about it. They're calling it NASA's moon crisis. Russia appears to be, well, they don't appear to be, they are saying that they're going to go back to the moon. They're
mm-hmm.
teaming up with India.
Yeah.
And they're working together to go back to the moon. Now, Russia had originally invited the U.S. to go, and we turned them down for reasons that were never explained.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems very likely that Russia wants to go back there to be able to explore these ruins.
Do you get the feeling that that is the consensus and that is why Russian media is so interested in it? Or is it more, again, a kind of, very sensation-oriented thing?
It's difficult to say. There is circumstantial evidence that Putin himself is responsible for this happening. But again, it's circumstantial. So it could be that it has nothing to do with him. It is true that, like, Pravda is a relatively major media organ in Russia, and that they fairly frequently cover all sorts of New Age metaphysical things.
Sure.
In general, the U.S. is probably one of the most backwards countries in the world in terms of totally denying the metaphysical and the spiritual from its media.
Hmm.
The Russians are more open-minded, as are many other countries. We don't really know, but it does seem that the sheer intensity with which they've grabbed the story, how much they're promoting the story, the amount of coverage that he's getting, the films, the documentaries they're doing, they've actually flown out to film him again
mm-hmm.
for another major news show.
Hmm.
They're really not going to leave this alone. And it's going to be very interesting because sooner or later, it's going to create enough political pressure that it should help usher in a disclosure, and that would be a really phenomenal thing to happen.
Yeah, there are so many nations now that is kind of again looking at the moon, and it, you know, it's you were speaking about cycles earlier in the first segment, and
right.
One tends to wonder, you know, okay, we were there in 69 and a few years, you know, beyond that, but then for some reason nothing happens, at least not in the official, you know, scene, so to speak, but now people are looking at it again, or, you know, China is looking at it, India and Russia, as you say, the U.S. is want to go back again, and Japan is sending, you know, probes up there to photograph and stuff. Is this something to do with the cycles, or have there had this other space program going all of this time to actually explore stuff on the moon, but we hear nothing about it, you know?
Well, there's a lot of legends that suggest very strongly that the last major technological civilization on Earth, which some people call Atlantis, there was actually more than one civilization. There was Atlantis and there was Rama, which was the one focused in India. That they warred with each other and they had colonized the moon. Some of the Atlantean memory of that is preserved in the Tibetan scriptures. There's Tibetan scriptures that very clearly describe what appear to be spacecraft and very clearly describe, you know, moon exploration and bases on the moon and so forth. So it appears that the Atlanteans had mastered anti-gravity, among other things. And once you start using anti-gravity propulsion, it becomes very easy to travel outside the Earth and go to Mars or go to the moon or whatever. The glass that you would build these domes out of is very easily mined from the lunar soil, because the lunar soil is essentially, all you have to do is a very mild amount of processing on it, and you can get glass right out of it. So it's easy to build. And also because the gravity is a lot lower, it doesn't take as much energy to hold up. You can build a much larger structure and not worry about it falling over. And glass actually, in terms of its strength, is actually stronger than steel when you start getting into the larger structures and building pylons out of glass and so forth. It's very, very strong.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So do you, you know, personally believe or have theories about that this is traces of humans being up there, or is this, you know, ET?
Yeah, in fact, what I've already said is probably more speculative than what Richard would be willing to go public with.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is definitely my belief that the ancient civilization of Atlantis was real. I mean, it's funny because I, you know, if you go back to that chapter in Shift of the Ages I was telling you about on my website, divinecosmos.com, in that chapter, you will see coverage from BBC, coverage from National Geographic, mainstream media organs describing pyramids, Stonehenge, buildings, roads, under the sea, around Cuba. See, this is what they do. They put the stuff out there just enough that they won't get caught with their pants down in the event that it gets disclosed in the future. They can say, no, we talked about it right here. But then they never really promote it. They just put a little thing out on the net, and it rises and it falls and it's gone. Nobody pays attention. So again, you know, this area around Cuba couldn't have been above ground earlier than probably 11,000-12,000 years ago. And yet there is very clear evidence of like volcanic ash that they found, and things that would indicate that the structures had to be above water. So the point is, you know, all the evidence is there. Anybody who says that these ancient civilizations didn't exist is simply turning their head from the evidence. And then when you consider the fact that these guys obviously had to have some levitation technology, there's no way you can manipulate pieces of granite of this size where you're dealing with multi-ton blocks. There's no crane in the world that's large enough to be able to lift these blocks right now. There has to be some sort of technology that nullifies gravity. And as soon as you accept that, as soon as you accept that they could levitate blocks, why couldn't they levitate a ship right on out of the Earth's atmosphere into space?
Sure, exactly.
So it becomes pretty darn obvious that there's a lot more going on than we've been told. And the other countries, honestly, as far as I can tell, are frustrated, and they don't want to play the game anymore. They're ready for the disclosure to be over. They're ready to have the truth come out. And the real defining moment is going to be video footage of an astronaut in front of a big structure that shouldn't be there on the moon. Now, that's what we're waiting for.
It may never happen
because 2012 may happen sooner, but
I think there's
a lot of surprises that are in store for us between now and 2012. I don't think we've seen the end by any stretch. I think there's a lot of things coming down.
What do you mean by that, that we might not see it because 2012 happened before that time? What do you mean by that?
Well, it takes a long time to do a moon mission. You know, you gotta build all your specialized ships, and then you gotta hit the launch windows. And typically, you don't want to land people the first time. You want to send a few where you just kind of make sure that you're going to be able to do it. It would be wonderful if they could get some kind of results by 2010, and actually have astronauts on the surface and be filming these structures by then. That would be great. And I would want nothing more than for that to be true. I just don't know if, you know, Are the economies going to stay stable enough to do that? Mm. Is the political will going to be there? You know, et cetera. There's all sorts of considerations.
So you're saying that...
I do think that other countries are tired of the cover-up. And, you know, we've already had certain countries release their UFO files, including France. So there's a lot of stuff that's still waiting to happen. And, again, I think 2008, and as the world situation gets more perilous and the economy gets weirder, I think you're going to see more and more of this stuff start to come out.
Hmm. Are you saying that if we go beyond 2012 and haven't been to the moon by then, that we won't make it? Or what do you mean?
Well,
I mean, we could do it just afterwards.
It ties back in with the deepest esoteric view of 2012, in which you're dealing with essentially a reality shift. So after 2012, our civilization will have changed or will change in such a dramatic fashion.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, after that time, we're going to know about Atlantis, we're going to know about the ruins on the moon, ruins on Mars. It's going to be a whole different game. Mm-hmm. And actually, the consciousness frequency is going to change. It's going to be much, much easier to have paranormal ability than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it may even be, if you look at the ancient prophecies, that some people will be able to levitate, do spontaneous healing, spontaneous telepathy, all sorts of things that we would now only relegate to the realm of miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can kind of see the seeds for that with that Spottiswood study I was telling you about, where your position in the galaxy, or relative to the galaxy, can increase your psychic ability by up to 400%.
Mm-hmm.
So if galactic energy strikes your DNA at the right time, you know, one of the things I've done with DNA is chart evolution. Most people think evolution is Darwinian, that it's basically random mutations and that they occur gradually over long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
Not really true. Evolution occurs in sudden spikes that are separated by, again, regular cycles of time. There's one cycle that's like 65 million years, 64, 65. There's another cycle that's 26 million years. And they repeat in very regular intervals. And during those times, at the end of the cycle, you have all the species on the planet suddenly evolve into more intelligent and highly structured organisms.
Hmm.
And we're, again, it appears on multiple levels that we're at another one of those cycles now. So
this occurring jumps, that's what you're saying here.
Yeah, hmm. Yeah. And it actually does cause biological change.
Jeez. Do you think that this...
I mean, we have all the evidence. We already have the proof, right? Mm-hmm. It's already happened over and over and over.
Sure, sure.
Huh. Well, you got Dr. Robert Rode from UC Berkeley, who discovered the 64, 65 million year cycle. You got David Rope and James Sepkoski, two University of Chicago paleontologists. They discovered the 26 million year cycle. They didn't want to find this thing. They were trying to get rid of it, and they kept doing more and more work to make their data better and better so that they could get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the more they worked, the more they found it.
Hmm.
And it should be one of the great stories of our time, and it's another one that just kind of gets stuffed under the rug, sort of like the expanding Earth theory we were talking about
before. Mm, yeah.
I mean, it's obvious. You look at the data, it's like, there it is.
So,
Obviously, if it's happened before, it's got to be able to happen again. You know,
probably,
it's
seems...
a repeating system.
Exactly. How about the another aspect here that I like to kind of look at and kind of incorporate into the ideas of when we're talking about evolution or some kind of jump in advancement, you know, if it's spiritual or has to do with, you know, the body or our DNA, whatever. How about the technological aspect of this? If we talk about, for instance, things like levitation, apparently... Science have begun looking at this and even claim to have solved pieces of this.
Sure.
You can teleport. I think it was protons or neurons that they were able to teleport. You can even tie in the fact of telepathy into this. They're now looking at things that are happening in things that are existent, I should say, in the brain, like brain sand, for instance, a crystalline structure that is in your pineal gland, and it can apparently activate this through technology similar to cell phone technology. What do you think that the ancients were actually talking about if they were prophesizing, for instance, stuff like telepathy or levitation, that we are approaching now a point where we can technologically come to this level. So this actually might not have at all anything to do with the spiritual aspect. What's your response to that?
Well, there's multiple ways you can spin 2012, and there's multiple ways you can look at it. It is true that the Atlanteans were highly aware of a technology that has been lost to our modern world, and that based on where our modern technology is, the Atlantean technology is a superior technology. And it's superior for several reasons. One of the reasons is that it's a technology that incorporates consciousness with machines. So that you can power the machine with your thoughts. So if you get into an anti-gravity craft built by Atlanteans, not only is it anti-gravity, but you basically think where you want to go, and it will go that way because it's responding to your consciousness.
Yeah.
The Atlanteans and the Ramans, you got basically two major societies that were at war and actually did have a nuclear holocaust that killed an enormous number of people. They were aware of a global grid, of the sacred geometry that overlays the Earth. They used the grid because where the lines cross, you get these vortexes, and there's energy that can be harnessed there. They used the pyramid technology because it will reduce severe weather, reduces earthquakes. It will, transform the consciousness of the people in the area. It performs healing. So the energy that we're dealing with that the Atlanteans were aware of is an energy that's just now starting to be rediscovered on a very primitive level. Technologically speaking, yes. One could say that as we begin using this energy in a technological fashion, it will have an inevitable effect on our overall evolution. There's no question of that.
Yeah.
However, the Atlanteans used it and had it, and look at what they did to themselves.
That's right.
It appears from the esoteric material I've studied that the main reason why Atlantis sank was because of the damage that the nuclear war did to the Earth, such that it caused the continent to sink. That's basically what happened, is the nukes actually caused a pole shift, and it was an unanticipated pole shift. It shouldn't have happened, but it caused what we now know of as Antarctica to become, it used to be Atlantis, and then the poles changed. And all the water came over it, and it turned into a big ice cap.
Really?
I spoke to a guy who worked in the black ops community in the U.S., had extensive interviews with the guy. This is the Montauk guy. And another thing I haven't gone public with before, but he confirmed repeatedly to me that they had discovered Atlantis under the Antarctica, inside the ice. Most of it is gone because basically you're dealing with enormous glaciers that have so much pressure that they just crushed all these pyramids and so forth down to rubble. But there's a few places like Lake Vostok.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, where they found stuff. And one of the things he told me they found, again, this is brand new information, is they found a series of spheres that were models of the Earth. And these spheres were made of an indestructible metal. You couldn't burn it, you couldn't cut it, you couldn't do anything to it. And each sphere represented the Earth at a different stage of expansion. So you could see the continents expanding, and that's how our guys apparently figured out that the Earth was expanding in the first place, was they found these Atlantean models under the ice of Antarctica.
Sheesh, okay.
But they found pyramids down there, and actually that whole thing was covered in that movie Alien vs. Predator.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Exactly. That's right.
Yep. So they let the truth out little bit by little bit, but then if somebody tries to say, oh, yeah, then they say, oh, you're just making fun of that movie Alien vs. Predator.
Sure.
And whatever.
Exactly. Huh.
So, yeah, there's a lot to know. And anyway, I think you were asking me something and I got off track. So.
No, it's fine. I mean, that's amazing information and very interesting. Was this Stuart Swerdlow you were talking about?
No, this is not Swerdlow, although the man I'm speaking of knew Stuart Swerdlow.
Okay.
He was another guy who worked there.
Like
no, this is a very interesting situation. The man who I'm in contact with has never gone public. He has never spoken to anyone else ever about this. I'm like, basically, he has some associates. There were some people who were in the black ops community that they called the... I think they call it the network or the underground or something like that. And he stayed in contact with them, and he showed me pictures of what they call sub-shuttles, which are these bullet trains that run underneath the land in America that were built for basically transportation from one secret base to another. So I did see a photograph of what was apparently a sub-shuttle. You know, and just a, an incredible amount of information that he gave me that is just beyond the realm of fascinating.
Do you know if this primarily is the military who is involved in this project, or do you know who's behind it?
You can't really say it's the military. That's not really an accurate assessment. You have a variety of organs within the defense community, and these are oftentimes private contractors. And they may be affiliated with some of these secret power groups, but as far as the military, no, they're generally not military. There's a bunch of corporations I could name. In fact, he told me the corporation that he was working for, this is public domain now, it's Brookhaven Laboratories, was the company that was doing Montauk. So that's not the defense that's not the defense contractor, that's something else. And you know, so what you're dealing with is basically secret societies that create these dummy corporations so that they can bill themselves for their own work and then make it look like, you know, it's all a separate entity. But primarily, Montauk was run by ex-Nazis that were still actually wearing the uniforms, had relocated to the southern tip of Brazil, which is where they still are. And, you know, they funded the project through apparently some gold that they, Nazi gold that they were able to recover. Great deal of it, actually. And, you know, they were apparently Montauk Point was where the subs were coming in with Germans after World War II as part of the Project Paperclip thing. And then they just started to experiment with really strange things. You know, the Nazis had found some very unique and strange stuff. And that was a major part of what Hitler was doing in World War II, was dispatching people to locations to try to reconstitute the ancient knowledge and regain the technology. And then all that stuff kind of got distributed after World War II. Some of it went to Russia, but a lot of it went to the U.S. And in fact, one of the things Richard talks about in his books is how many of these top Nazi scientists became top NASA scientists. So nothing really has changed, you know. And,
yeah, exactly. Do you think that the agenda has kind of continued? I mean, obviously the Nazis could spearhead this in a way that few other nations could at the time. I mean, they had the power to go into nations. They could occupy territories and do a lot of stuff. And a consequence of that is because if the scientists and people from the Nazi era are just brought over and you know, the project continues, but more at that level, I guess, underground, you know?
Yeah, sure. You know, the ideology was brought over, the belief structure was brought over, the method of getting things done was brought over. That's why, you know, those who believe 9/11 was an inside job, you can see that it has all the trademarks of what we now know was a deliberate sabotage of Hitler against his own parliament building, which he then blamed on Poland.
Is it another time loop thing here, or is this, again, as you're saying...
It's just like, you know, if you have an inside book that says, you know, figure out who your enemy is, and then create a self-inflicted wound and blame it on your enemy so you can invade his country.
Absolutely, I totally agree, and I think that that is what happened too, but what I'm asking is, do you think that they...
the cycles. Yeah, I mean, it's possible. It's possible that that's part of it, sure.
And they might be aware?
You know, one of the things that Michelle Helmer discovered was cycles can expand or contract in terms of the speed that things unfold.
Okay.
So he found a 1-7 ratio between the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution. In other words, the French Revolution took longer. The Russian Revolution, if you look at it, the same events happened, but 7 times faster.
Sheesh. That's so interesting. I mean, exactly. And what I'm saying here, or what I'm asking here is, could they up there that are, you know, orchestrating 9/11 type events and the consequent things that are unfolding because of that event, but do you think they could be aware of these time cycles themselves so they could operate within the time frame that kind of favors these kind of events and things?
I've never even thought of that, but you're probably right. They probably do know this. There is so much knowledge that they're holding on to secretly.
Mm-hmm.
It's just mind-boggling. The fact of the matter is also, you look at the markets, the way the economy moves, there is astonishing correlations between positions of planets and the actual positions of the stock market graphs.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the cycles which I list in Shift of the Ages is Saturn-Uranus. What they do is they composite those two planets' movements together so that you're basically getting the summation wave of the two planets as they go.
Hmm.
And that wave has an enormous impact on the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Really?
Yeah. So there's no question that, the way that we feel, whether we feel good or whether we feel bad, can be totally affected by astrology and by planet position and so forth.
Sure, sure.
And it does appear to be a lot more subtle than that. So, yeah, insofar as they've probably done the calculations, they've probably seen how the cycles work, and they probably have tried to time events so that they are for the maximum benefit. And in that sense, you could probably argue that 9/11 was planned so that it would occur at a pivotal cyclical moment so that the result could be manipulated. That is probably true. I just had never thought of that before.
I mean, just look at the thing with 9/11. If we take into effect that we consider that the millennium shift actually occurred from 2000 over to 2001 and not the other way around, so we celebrated it a year early, people would argue. But anyway, it feels like the new millennium going in here is after the New Year's celebration from 2000 over to 2001, and then we have kind of a gestation period of 9 months, basically, where 9/11 happens, which kind of is the birthing point that I see it of this, new millennium, or kind of a signal or some kind of communication on a very subtle level. I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I was getting so much. It's a very fascinating concept. And it sounds right. I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing that they would do. It does sound like that. I was getting an enormous amount of intuitive hits on 9/11 before it happened,
mm-hmm.
to the point that once it happened, it was like, oh, okay, that's what it was. I mean, I ran to my computer the day that it was happening and spent the whole day writing articles to put together all the dreams I'd had that were predicting it.
Really?
And I got it posted while it was still 9/11. Because I knew this was going to happen. I knew something was coming. I just didn't know how or when, but I kept seeing dream after dream after dream in which airplane crashes were associated with a sudden economic collapse. And I'm like, what in the world would an airplane crash have to do with the economy collapsing?
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't put it together. As soon as it happened, I was like, oh, that's what it is. Okay.
Sheesh.
But, it's important when we talk about these things that we not invoke a sense of fear in the listener to think that these guys are so powerful that they can actually throw off the positive future that we have. These guys, we're also dealing with, and we got to remember this, we're dealing with other forms of human life that are a lot more evolved than we are. They're just humans from other planets,
mm-hmm.
and they're visiting us. This is no joke. I mean, the UFOs are a real thing. If even one UFO sighting that anybody's had after all this time, and that goes back to the Bible with Ezekiel, and that goes back to every ancient culture, the Japanese had the Anemono Todobune, which is the flying boats from the universe, is the translation.
Mm-hmm.
Every culture has this stuff.
Sure.
In Egypt they have the winged disc.
Yeah.
It's a flying disc, right? It's everywhere. So if even one of these sightings is real, then that means there are visitors.
That's
right. That means that we're not alone. So you have to expand the focus a little bit, actually quite a bit, and realize that we're basically living in a reality structure. This gets into the more deeply esoteric material,
mm-hmm.
in which the entire cosmos is a living intelligent organism.
Yeah.
Vastly more complicated than we could ever fathom. Our mind is basically like a very, very low-speed pocket calculator and compared to this supercomputer that the universe is.
Mm-hmm.
And as you evolve more and more, you go from being a pocket calculator to being a laptop to being a supercomputer. And
sure.
So there are beings out there that are much more evolved than we are, And we're all involved in a big spiritual experience. And the experience is one where we're evolving in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And that consciousness evolution is being very carefully watched over and nurtured and cultivated and protected. So what's happening with 2012 is essentially the galaxy is an intelligent organism, has programmed evolution to occur on its planets in given cycles of time, which is what we were talking about with the fossil record, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it pushes you from one level to another, and we're not at the end. It's going to keep pushing us. And 2012 is the crossing point. So these negative elite, like the Illuminati, are allowed to be there because we need to have projections of the parts of ourselves that we haven't faced and cleared.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
It's what happens in our personal lives. It's like if you don't love and respect yourself, don't be naive enough to think that somebody's going to fall in love with you and love and respect you. It's usually the opposite, right?
Yeah.
If you're not feeling good about yourself, then you're going to attract somebody who's going to victimize you and make you feel terrible.
Mm, yeah.
And so it's the same thing with our society. If we have a sickness that we're not willing to look at, and this gets down to like you know, if you have a family member, let's say, for example, you have a family member who's committing incest acts against his own daughter, right, which is one of the worst examples you can imagine.
Yeah.
And then the guy goes on and says, oh, I'm a good father. Yeah, you know, I haven't done anything wrong.
Mm.
I was teaching my daughter what she needs to know about sex. You go back to Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and he's describing how even with serial killers who are on death row, you talk to him about the people that he killed, and he said, no, I only killed people who needed my help.
Mm.
I only killed people who needed to go because they'd run out of time, and I didn't do anything wrong.
Mm.
You know?
Mm.
So until we basically realize, and you know, what's one of the biggest things that the government keeps doing? Keeps stealing our money, right?
Mm.
There's so many people who, if they find that wallet on the ground, and they look inside, and there's all sorts of cash in there. Yeah, they're probably going to drop the wallet in the mailbox, but they'll do it after they take the cash out.
Mm.
A lot of people will do that, and they just think, well, you know, this is my cut for giving you your wallet back.
Well, exactly. I mean, again, everyone is this, you know, everyone is different. They have their ideas about what life and you know, what this experience is all about. And
yeah.
And in the end, I don't see it as black as white that this is either right or this is wrong. This is
sure.
Levels of all of this. And
sure.
You know, to kind of summarize, I guess, what you're saying also about this with the conspiracy, with the Illuminati, with all the secret societies, with all the hidden agendas that is going on, that in the end, this is nothing to fear. This is an instrument that is there or actually a tool for us at this time. Because I see it that this actually opens up an opportunity for us to become aware of all this wonderful stuff about synchronicity, but also about actually how a lot of evil deeds and hidden agendas are you know played out, but this also heightens your awareness, I feel, on a whole new level. This makes you know.
Henrik, you are so right on. It's the Illuminati is the greatest living infomercial that we have for programs like yours and for websites like mine.
Yeah, exactly.
Because telling people everything you think you know is a lie.
Mm.
Everything you think you know is actually much more than what you know.
Yeah.
And you're only seeing a little tiny piece. And it's such a great dramatic way to literally feel and experience awakening, where you suddenly realize that the world that you knew is totally different.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it's a fantastic thing to do. And the only reason why the media has kept it so quiet is because they are all interconnected. It's all part of one system that primarily works on the profit. You know, it's not profitable to question the whole system, especially when those who are in the government are blackmailing and bribing you and threatening you that if you actually go forward with the story. I mean, look at this, right? A lot of people are saying it wasn't a good film in terms of, you know, film structure, the conventions of how to make movies, but, you know, the Robert Redford film, Lions for Lambs, had Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this film is blatantly telling the world how this happens in the media, how the truth is discovered and it tries to get out there, but then if somebody tries to put it out there, they basically just get silenced and the story is never published.
Hmm. Yeah.
So we have all the things we need to see it. There's movies that are showing us, there's
yeah.
books that you can read, there's even television programs you can watch, and yet it still hasn't quite reached that sort of pivotal moment where the whole world kind of says, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Something, this is all different than what we thought.
Yeah.
And we got to rethink everything.
Exactly.
Still trying to hold on to the old ways, and that's why guys like you and me doing this kind of work, it's like the gold rush, you know.
Yeah.
We're out there staking our claim to pieces of land before everybody comes running and looking for it.
Mm.
And so if we can get ourselves positioned now, that's great, because in the future, this is going to be taken a lot more seriously.
Well,
there's
exactly.
very exciting things happening that I can't talk about publicly that suggest that that's on its way and that I will be involved in it in other ways.
But,
you know,
interesting. Yeah,
none
exactly.
of this stuff, you don't want to talk about it until you know that it's going to happen. But
sure, sure. Well, exactly. Yeah. I totally agree with you. I think that this is a point where more and more people are going to, you know, actually become more aware of this. It's nothing that I kind of sit around and waiting for and kind of anticipate, because I know that I'm going to do what I do, you know, no matter what everyone else does. This isn't in that sort of way. I feel that those who can't, you know, muster, so to speak, the material, or can't, you know, get a grip on it. I guess that this information isn't for them, but that doesn't mean that they at some point won't wake up and won't, you know, begin to open up into new areas, you know.
Yeah, and I've discovered that the power of audio is orders of magnitude better than the power of writing something on a web page, and I discovered that the power of a video is order of magnitude better than the power of an audio. And
that's
just
right.
Because the people who are sitting on the fence, they're never going to read something. They may be willing to listen to something, but if you send them a video, they say, oh, let me see what this guy looks like.
Yeah, that's right.
And then boom.
So it was also, that.
It's important to attack it on all fronts.
Exactly. And was that kind of your intention and your kind of frame of mind when you began working on this film project, that the best way to go about this is actually to make a film, and even not a documentary, but actually a fiction film, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's the same thing that our friends in the Illuminati used, and I say friends as sort of tongue-in-cheek, of course, but our friends in the Illuminati used this with Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
Because as I've said on other programs, the basics of Da Vinci Code was to establish the idea that Jesus had a bloodline, which then, through another sleight of hand, would become the bloodline of the elite, the ruling class.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was so obvious, especially with James Cameron, The Lost Tomb of Jesus, where he says, hey, here's the sarcophagus, here's the coffin of Jesus, and we tested the DNA in the coffin, and it's the same as, you know, the kid.
Yeah.
Right? Well, then the next step, if everybody had gotten into that, which they didn't, I mean, you know, the books were all being sold for, like, ridiculously low prices, and film didn't do very well, but if it had gotten really popular, then the next step would be, oh, wow, look at this. The DNA matches George W. Bush. The DNA matches Tony Blair.
Jeez.
DNA matches the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers. Wow.
Well, don't those guys actually have genetic relations all the way back to, like, Ramses II or something anyway? So.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, that is part of it. The bloodline is very much part of it. Now,
sure.
they're not all like, Merovingian, like the, you know, the Jesus bloodline that went to France and so forth. But, yeah, they definitely have... you know, it's tied in with King David, the Davidic line,
yeah.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah,
even I think Vlad the Impaler, or AKA Dracula, actually is related to both Bush and Kerry. I think so. It's true. I
remember reading that.
Yeah, exactly. Sheesh. I mean, it's interesting anyway to look upon that. You know, again, I think that this is actually a good time to maybe round things up. I don't know if there's anything you wanna leave us with here. I mean, this has been an excellent interview, and I want to thank you so much again for coming on, and I would love to have you back at some point, David, and talk more.
Sure. There's... You know, Henrik, the mental energy that you ground in for a conversation is quite unique and rarefied. I can't really go to a frequency that's not conversant with what the person who's the host of the show can can actually handle.
Hmm.
And you're able to handle the maximum download speed, so to speak.
That's good.
And you also seem to be just completely up to speed with all the different things that I'm talking about. So so I've been pleasantly satisfied with this interview. I certainly remember looking at your site and saying, wow, you know, this guy's got some pretty unique and different and hard-hitting stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've looked at a lot of websites, and I actually have bookmarked a couple of pages on your site and say, I got to go back and read this.
Mm, good, good. I'm so glad to hear that, and thank you so much. I mean, that's
you know,
great to hear that.
If I'm ever in Sweden, it would be great to see you at some point.
Absolutely, oh, definitely.
Or maybe, I don't know, do you ever plan on doing conferences or anything, or...?
What I'm planning on doing actually is getting around and filming a lot, because I'm getting more and more involved all the time in film work, and one plan of mine is to actually go over to the US at some point and bring a you know film equipment with me and do something over there. So I mean
like I said, that's the holy grail.
Yeah,
and,
it is.
That's the best way to reach people.
That's right.
And I'm totally open to originally, we were kind of looking at the film and saying, "Well, we gotta control exposure, and we gotta make sure that we don't have you know David's image go out unless everybody is involved with it, and we can control how it's going to go." And that was basically the lawyers were saying that, entertainment lawyers from Hollywood were saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't want to do anything unless you control it.
Sure, sure.
But I think the bottom line is that you know that Project Camelot video. I mean. One of the two cameras, it looks like there's Vaseline on the lens, for God's sake.
That's right. Geez.
And, you know, it's obviously a homegrown project, but yet the impact that has had has been tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of email I've gotten, people that are just pouring out their hearts saying, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
just off the chart. And so the new approach is, look, the more ways that we can get this material out there to as many people as possible through as many different vehicles as possible, the better.
Mm, yeah.
Because I know what I have to offer. I know how unique and rare it is. And it's my desire, basically, to connect with people and basically teach them that this is a much more fascinating situation than you may have thought. This is the point we really ought to close on.
Mm.
And that is that it can be so compelling to get swept into the negativity. You can get swept into, oh, my gosh, the economy. Oh, my gosh, the Earth changes. Oh, my gosh, pole shift, Planet X, evil aliens might invade, yada, 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 all down the list.
Mm.
And I keep wanting to remind people, we are involved in the middle of a perfect plan. This is a plan that is orchestrated by a divine intelligence, a divine cosmos. It is a plan that is carefully studied and monitored by those who guard us and make sure that nothing is going to go wrong. There is free will on this planet. Negative things are allowed to happen. Holocausts have happened. Genocides have happened. That is all true. But it's important when you look at things like that to remember that you are a multidimensional being, that your body is not the extent of your identity. So you may have, you know, you may die. I mean, everybody dies at some point.
Mm.
But that's only a very small portion of who you are. We have multiple bodies of energy that live in different frequencies of consciousness, different dimensions, if you will, and we will always exist. We cannot die. We cannot be extinguished. Our consciousness is forever and omnipresent throughout the universe, and we are eventually returning to a oneness with God, to a oneness with the creation. So we're at a very, very unique point in this planet's history. It's very rare, first of all, for a planet like ours to be as asleep as our planet is. There's a lot of people here, and probably most of the people who listen to your show are actually these angelic souls. These are souls that started out from a higher frequency, a higher vibration, didn't need the human school, but they volunteered to be here because we're in so much need of help. And then once you come here, you get stuck here, you get karma, you have to reincarnate, and you end up going through lesson after lesson while also wondering why is it so disharmonious, why are people so deceptive, why do they think they can lie and get away with it, why do they think they can steal or kill or hurt people, and you can't make any sense out of it. So these are called wanderers, these people, and most of the people listening are probably wanderers right now.
Hmm.
So, you know, my message to the wanderers is basically, look, it's all going to work out, and you don't have to save the world. You're not the Messiah. Everybody's here as a team effort. We're all in this together. Each of us contributes when we can, and if you can't run the marathon, then hand the baton off for a while and take a breather. But the most important thing we need to do, especially the wanderers, is to try to just maintain as much harmony as we can. Each person who stays in harmony is like a lens of light that is focusing the peace and the higher consciousness for the planet so that we can all unify together and have less war, less disharmony. So it really is true, once again, that if you work your own process, that you're helping everyone. And I do want to just stress one last time that the Science of Peace series is quite the spiritual experience that helps you clarify that intention and be able to really understand on an intellectual level how your mind works and how all these different elements factor in. Absolutely. So yeah, this has been really great, and I would love to do another show with you. This was an excellent energy created, and I'm very honored to have been here. So there's a lot more we can talk about. This is just the beginning. So.
That's right, exactly. And thank you for that last.
It's been great for me.
Yeah, thank you for that last note. I mean, excellent point to leave off with after a discussion like this. And again, everyone, I encourage you to head on over to divinecosmos.com and check out that Science of Peace series, the audio series. Also check out some of the articles and books that David has up there for you. So much more to check out. And again, thank you so much for coming on, David. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Henrik. It's been a pleasure for me, too.